and slam the golden door. Dr. Francis.
It's always an honor to be asked to speak to the annual RRR conference. And one of the interesting things about speaking at them is that Lou Rockwell always picks the titles of your speech. They're usually very good titles, but it's always interesting to see if the speaker understands them in the same sense that Lou did, let alone whether the audience understands either one of us. In the case of the title, Slam That Golden Door, I think I'm correct in assuming that Lou did not want me to attack the gold standard. The golden door, of course, comes from the last line of one of Lou's favorite poems, the one by Emma Lazarus on the Statue of Liberty, the line that reads, "I lift my lamp beside the golden door." The golden door meaning presumably the gateway to the utopia of goodies that the European immigrants expected to find in the United States. The statue, of course, never had anything to do with the open borders policy that it was hijacked to symbolize. It was intended simply as a commemoration of our national independence and our republican liberty. But Miss Lazarus's poem, written well before the erection of the statue, was the agent of the hijacking. As Stephen Birmingham explains in his book, Our Crowd, on the Jewish Families of New York, she wrote the poem as an effort to raise funds for putting the statue up. But because she was by background a Sephardic Jew, and because many of the recent Jewish immigrants to the United States were German and East European Jews, the latter regarded her line about the wretched refuse of your teeming shores to be a nasty crack about them. So the result was that the money raised to put up the Statue of Liberty was largely collected among Sephardic Jews who had come to this country earlier, and the German and East European Jews tended to boycott the fundraising campaign. The irony of this story, of course, is that a statue and a memorial hijacked to celebrate immigration and the assimilationist ideal of the melting pot was actually an occasion for ethnic resentment. And despite the eventual assimilation of most European immigrants of the 19th century, that kind of ethnic conflict is in fact the major effect of uncontrolled immigration. And that is precisely why we should slam the golden door and erase Miss Lazarus's goopy doggerel from what ought to be an inspiring monument to American Republican liberty. Immigration policy, of course, is now a major political issue, and nowhere more so than in the state where we are meeting, whose citizens have done so much to make it a national issue through passage of Proposition 187 last year. Prop 187 passed overwhelmingly despite the concerted opposition of the Republicans and the Democrats and the establishment media, and despite the threats of violence to many of the grassroots activists who worked so hard for it. Ever since then, immigration reform has been muttered about in the Gingrich Congress, though nothing has been done about it. Both Gingrich and Dick Armey, as well as the Clinton administration, are opposed to controlling legal immigration at all. And our beloved neoconservative friends are militantly opposed to any reform. Indeed, as Morton Kondracki wrote in his column in Roll Call last year, it was William Crystal, now editor of the neoconservative Weekly Reader, excuse me, I mean the Weekly Standard, who persuaded Jack Kemp and Bill Bennett that it would be a terrific idea for them to come out against 187 on the eve of the election. It was, in fact, a terrific idea, because more than anything else, the Kemp-Bennett denunciation of 187 led to the collapse of their political careers. Yeah. As an encore, the same three have been pushing the Colin Powell candidacy, which has now turned out to be even more of a bigger bomb for them than their earlier brainstorm. The perfidy of neoconservatives in the Republican establishment on immigration was bad enough, but even worse was the conduct of our own government in the wake of the 187 victory. After massive, concerted intimidation by Mexicans in the United States against Californians who supported the proposition, and after open intervention against the proposition by the Mexican government itself, including its own diplomats in California, the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City actually apologized to the Mexican government for the passage of 187. And soon afterwards, several other Latin American diplomats also denounced the United States for permitting it to pass. I don't know what they thought we were supposed to do about it. It was a state measure. And discussed having it invalidated by the United Nations and the World Court. Of course, our own government did nothing to protest Mexican intervention in our internal affairs and politics. And where immigration is concerned, that's par for the course. Even after passage of 187, the courts lost no time in declaring it unconstitutional, and school officials in California announced they wouldn't obey it anyway. I mention these incidents because they show the deep division in our society over the immigration issue. The elites, whether political or cultural or judicial, are for immigration, while the vast majority of the American people are opposed to it. 187, you'll remember, passed overwhelmingly by about 60% or more than that, even though polls supposedly showed that it might fail, and many commentators predicted its failure. But at the same time, and for some years now, almost all public opinion polls show that a large majority of Americans of all races and ethnic backgrounds overwhelmingly oppose immigration and want it controlled or even stopped. But despite that clear message of massive popular opposition, immigration, largely from third world non-European countries, continues at the highest levels ever known in American history and is beginning to exert significant long-term effects on what America looks like and what America will be in the not-too-distant future. In 1992, the U.S. Census Bureau published a report that spelled out the future demographic features of the United States as a result of present-day and projected immigration patterns and the birth rates of the immigrants. The report concluded that by about the year 2050, the Hispanic part of the U.S. population will have grown from 9.4% of the population to 21%, that the Asian and Pacific Islander portion will have risen from 3.5% to 10.7%, that the black population is projected to almost double from 32 million to 62 million, but that the non-Hispanic white share of the U.S. population would steadily fall from 75% in 1992 to about 53% in 2050. While non-whites and Hispanics will increase by some 120 million between 1992 and 2050, the non-Hispanic white population will grow by a mere 11 million in that period. And by the middle of the next century, whites will be on the eve of becoming a minority in the United States. The report finds that non-Hispanic whites, quote, would contribute nothing to population growth after 2030 because the non-Hispanic group would be declining in size, unquote. What this means, of course, is that by the middle of the next century, for the first time in American history, the white or European portion of the population, which settled North America, founded the United States, and has been the dominant core of the American population and American culture from its origins, will have become a minority in its own country. The middle of the next century is no longer a date in a science fiction novel. It's less than 60 years away, and young children born of white parents in the last couple of years will live to see themselves become a minority in their own country. It is all but unimaginable that this demographic and racial revolution will not have the most far-reaching consequences for the political and cultural future of the United States. And we already see the beginnings of those consequences in what some are already calling the Brazilianization of America, the transformation of the country into a third world society and economy in which a small slice of the population prevails at the top over a mass of economically depressed non-whites throughout the rest of the society. We also see the consequences in the emergence of an explicit anti-white racial consciousness among both native blacks and immigrants, including a bubbling irredentist and separatist movement among Latinos in Southern California and elsewhere. And we see the results of immigration in the rise of multiculturalism in both education and increasingly in private institutions, where the heritage of white European Americans is debunked and discarded, and European Americans themselves are dispossessed of their country and their culture. Of course, there is an alternative view that the United States possesses some inherent or almost magical capacity to absorb and assimilate its immigrants, and that that process will continue to work even under the large-scale immigration and different birth rates that the Census Bureau reports. The same people who argue for our apparently infinite capacity to assimilate immigrants and claim that the massive infusion of non-Westerners will have no cultural effect on the receiving culture also often argue that the immigrants will have a positive cultural effect, that they bring habits of hard work, ambition, religion, and the much-touted family values to a country and a people that has become lazy, irreligious, and licentious. Moreover, the cliché of the immigrationists, those who oppose virtually all restrictions on immigration, is that America is, after all, a nation of immigrants, and that it would be un-American, indeed xenophobic or racist, to restrict immigration. Yet the fact is that throughout our history, the United States has repeatedly restricted immigration in order to select the kind of population and the kind of culture that its people wanted. There is nothing un-American about restricting immigration for those reasons. This has been true since the earliest days of American history. The leaders of both colonial Massachusetts and Virginia did not allow just anyone to come to those colonies who wanted to come. An applicant for immigration to Massachusetts had to be interviewed by the Massachusetts Bay Company to determine if he met the religious and moral standards of the colony, and the Puritan founders of Massachusetts deliberately excluded both British aristocrats and the British poor from immigrating. They wanted a middle-class society. The leaders of colonial Virginia also sought to restrict immigration so as to select a population that would contribute to the building of the kind of society they wanted. At the time of the American Revolution, the founding fathers were virtually unanimous in opposing easy immigration to the new republic. Last year, in my remarks to the Randolph Club in Washington, I quoted some of the founders on immigration using Dr. Wayne Lutton's research in his monograph, The Myth of Open Borders. And I'll repeat some of that material here. Both Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, who rarely agreed on anything else, were at one in their view of immigration. Jefferson wrote in his Notes on the State of Virginia that immigrants from monarchical countries should be discouraged from immigrating. Quote, "They will bring with them the principles of the governments they leave, or if able to throw them off, it will be in exchange for an unbounded licentiousness, passing as usual from one extreme to the other. It would be a miracle were they to stop precisely at the point of temperate liberty." Alexander Hamilton, in a speech of 1802, agreed. The opinion expressed in Notes on Virginia, he said, is undoubtedly correct, that foreigners will generally be apt to bring with them attachments to the persons they have left behind, to the country of their nativity, and to its particular customs and manners. The influx of foreigners must therefore tend to produce a heterogeneous compound to change and corrupt the national spirit, to complicate and confound public opinion, to introduce foreign propensities. George Washington wrote to John Adams in 1794 that, "My opinion with respect to immigration is that except of useful mechanics and some particular description of men and professions, there is no use of encouragement." And later he wrote, "I have no intention to invite immigrants, even if there are no restrictive acts against it. I am opposed to it altogether." These sentiments were commonplace among the leaders and founders of the American Republic. And of course, they were mainly thinking of European immigrants. It probably never occurred to most of them that Asians, Africans, and Latin Americans would one day displace even the Europeans whose coming they opposed. Much of the early American legislation against immigration was enacted at the state or local rather than the national level. And in the 1820s and 1830s, Boston, New York, Baltimore, and New Orleans all sought to curtail the practice of some European countries of dumping their paupers, vagrants, and criminals into U.S. ports. One reason there was not more federal legislation earlier was that immigration came in waves, and when there was no immigrant tide, there was no reason to build legal walls against it. But whenever the tide of immigration has increased, Congress in the past has always taken measures to stop it or control it. Indeed, in the very first congressional statute regulating the naturalization of foreigners as citizens, passed in 1790, it was explicitly stipulated that citizenship was restricted, quote, "to any alien being a free white person," unquote. There were other stipulations, namely that you had to be of sound moral character and you had to be economically self-supporting. The myth of open borders, the myth that we are a nation of immigrants, Emma Lazarus's myth of the golden door, always open to anyone who shows up, is simply a lie. In the course of our history, we have had immigration restrictions based on economic condition, race, religion, morals, health, political views, criminal background, cultural habits, and mental capacities. Measures to those effects were passed in the 1880s and 1890s. And eventually, the 1924 Immigration Act enacted the National Origins Test, by which immigrants from other countries could enter the United States in proportion to the past contributions of those countries to the American population. The 1924 Act remained the law until it was replaced by the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952. But the new law retained the national origin system and also excluded aliens who were, among other things, convicted criminals, communists, anarchists, drug addicts, drug pushers, lunatics, prostitutes, sex deviants, or mental or physical defectives. Of course, today that list sounds more like a description of the Clinton cabinet than anything else. Only in 1965 was the national origin system abandoned, although both supporters and opponents of the 1965 law that did away with the national origins test argued that the new law should not or would not alter the traditional cultural character and ethnic composition of the country. It was, in other words, a given of the 1965 debate that retaining our traditional ethnic and cultural character was desirable, and Congress consented to the new law on that understanding. It was, of course, an understanding that was in error, since the abolition of the national origins test made possible the third world invasion that we are seeing today and the racial and cultural revolution we and our children will live to experience. My point in recounting this history is merely to show that throughout our national history, we have never followed a policy of open borders or subscribed to the notion that anyone who wants to come here, barring convicted criminals, may immigrate. I'm not all that familiar with the immigration histories of other countries, but it would seem to me that the United States, throughout its history, up until very recently, has had one of the most restrictive and one of the most carefully selective immigration policies in the world. Yet despite the economic cost to the taxpayers of aliens who receive welfare, education, health care, law enforcement, and other services, the major problem that massive third world immigration presents to us remains cultural. Supporters of immigration, like Ben Wattenberg and other neoconservatives, who argue that even third world immigrants assimilate quickly, simply subscribe to a superficial idea of what culture is. They seem to think that once an immigrant has started wearing t-shirts and blue jeans, learned pidgin English, eaten a few quarter pounders with cheese, and started slobbering over Michael Jackson and Madonna, he has become an American. In a minimal sense, perhaps he has. But in the first place, even in the minimal sense, immigrants often seem to assimilate less than is supposed. One test of this is language, and the evidence is that an increasing number of immigrants continue to speak a foreign language at home. In New York City, for example, in 1980, 35% of all residents spoke a foreign language at home. By 1992, that had increased to 41%, and nearly half of these said they did not speak English well. In Miami, nearly 75% speak a foreign language at home, and 67% say they don't speak English well. While some 45 different languages are spoken in the New York City school system, some 60 different languages were spoken in the homes of students at Los Angeles's Hollywood High School in 1980, and as many as 83 languages were spoken in Los Angeles County. In 1989, a Census Bureau report showed a 40% increase in the 1980s of those who speak a foreign language at home. In just 1 year, between 1990 and 91, the number of limited English students in American schools increased by 14.3% to more than 2 million. Thus, even by the standards of minimal assimilation, the evidence is that an increasing number of immigrants are continuing to adhere to languages other than the traditional language of American civilization, government, and literature. In the absence of common language, a common culture and a common nationality are simply meaningless. Language is merely the minimal test of assimilation. Another and more meaningful test is religion. We know that there are now more Muslims in the United States than there are Episcopalians, though admittedly the Muslims may be closer to traditional Christianity. We also know that cults like Santeria are highly popular among Caribbean immigrants, and that the practice of sorcery and animal sacrifice that Santeria and similar cults indulge strike us as highly offensive and barbaric. There was a fairly recent case before the Supreme Court in which the Santeria cult in Hialeah, Florida, challenged the constitutionality of a local law that bans animal sacrifice. The court ruled for the Santerians, so that now neither Hialeah nor any other city can outlaw the killing or torture of animals for religious purposes. In San Francisco, some 500 animals every year are sacrificed to Babalu, a Santeria god who apparently received his name from a hit song recorded in the 1940s by Desi Arnaz. In 1993, as Haitian immigrants prepared to embark on their illegal voyages to the United States in anticipation of President Clinton's lifting the ban on them, one of the things they almost always made sure to do before setting out was to get a voodoo priest to use magic to help them make it across the sea. The Washington Post interviewed one Haitian who had already lost 23 relatives to drowning in two attempts to come to America, but he told them, quote, "We did not have the right magic last time. Next time we will have more powerful magic that will make us invisible. Who knows, he may be among us today." Indeed, in Miami, so serious has Santeria and voodoo become that officials at the county courthouse have instituted what they call the Voodoo Squad, whose job it is to go around in the morning and clean up the bodies of dead chickens, goats, pigeons, lizards, and other voodoo items from the courthouse grounds. It seems that adherents of Santeria and voodoo engage in these rituals on the grounds before their legal cases go to court. And in some cases, they sprinkle voodoo powders on the chairs of the judges to influence the judges' decisions. It actually may be more effective than trying to argue the law to many of our judges. What we are seeing in the demographic and racial revolution that mass immigration causes, then, is also a cultural revolution, a displacement of the traditional British and European culture of the peoples who discovered, created, and conquered North America and the United States by cultures and cultural fragments that are entirely non-Western. And if this revolution today is far more obvious in high-impact immigration states in areas like Southern California and Florida, it soon will become just as obvious as immigration begins to spread out into other regions of the country. Immigration, then, represents more than just higher costs for welfare or dislocation in employment. Immigration, more than any other demographic phenomenon of our time, means the end of Western and American civilization, and of the people who created that civilization as we have known them. And that meaning is upon us today. Slamming the golden door, if that is how we should think of protecting our nation, our people, and our civilization from the invasion that threatens them, is absolutely essential, nor would it involve either increases in the power of the federal government or any unusual expense or any departure from our real traditions as Americans. Ending immigration, legal and illegal, like so many of our other problems in this country, is really a simple matter. But it does require overcoming the political power of the business and political elites who want mass immigration for their own selfish purposes. And it requires an understanding that this nation and its culture and the Republican liberty that grows out of that culture are not the creatures of an intellectual abstraction, an idea, or a proposition, but that they are the product of a particular people and a particular historical heritage. We cannot preserve our liberty by building statues and wheezing bad poetry, or pretending that every other culture in the world is really composed of people who would be good Americans if only they had a chance, but only by preserving the people and reclaiming the heritage upon which our freedom really rests and without which it will vanish, as Peter Bremelow says in his recent book, Alien Nation, like a candle in the gale. Thank you.